Well, you guys, at this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the coolest guy I know, man, in AA. I love this dude, Kevin. Please.
You got this.
I'm Kevin, and I'm allergic to poison. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Marcus, for inviting me to do this. It means a lot to me. I've recently made a sponsorship change, and I want to thank Lee for being my new sponsor. That's not easy thing for me, being a people pleaser and to start a new chapter in my AA life, but I have a feeling he's the reason for some of you being here, but the crowd is overwhelming, and I have a lot of gratitude for the people in this room. I have a lot of gratitude for this room in general. This room scared the bejesus out of me, and what I did was I projected it onto you. I came in. I didn't want to do this, and so all of you were so ugly and so terrible and boring and everything I could think of that I could project onto you. But the fact was that I was scared to get sober. I was scared of who I was on the other side of that mountain that I had to cross. I was scared of who I would be. And I'm glad I'm here on Glenn's 8th birthday because when I came into these rooms, it was a podium meeting on the Friday night, and Glenn was the secretary of that meeting. And I simply came in with my wife at the time to show her that AA was horrible. And when you guys proved that, I could go home and she wouldn't rag on me for not going, right? Then we could go find some place where I could get sober. I had no idea where that was, but I had to get sober. And that meeting changed my life, to say the least. It changed way more than my life. It changed perspectives. It changed outlooks. It changed so much because you guys forced me to go inside. But we'll get into that. We'll start at the beginning. I was born in New Jersey, which they tell me is enough reason to be an alcoholic in itself. My father was a stockbroker, and he wanted to work on Wall Street once in his life. And I was the oldest child, and so once they had me, they scurried back to California to raise me here. When I was born in that hospital, I came out and cried and did all that stuff. And then they handed me a checklist. No one could see the checklist. They just handed it to me, and I had it for a long time. And that checklist included things that I needed to do to accomplish, to go after, to become happy. And I thought that checklist was extremely important. And so as soon as I possibly could, I started out on that checklist. In elementary school, let me talk about my parents real quick. I really believe that instead of coming out of my mother, I think they snuck me in. I think a little spaceship came by and dropped me off when they weren't looking and made it look like I was burdened there, because I don't know how I got these parents. I really don't have any valid excuse, any drama, any trauma that I can pinpoint back to me being an alcoholic. They were two absolutely wonderful people. But I don't know how they had me. My father was a Division I basketball player. He was born in a boxcar in the Depression in Minnesota and worked his way all the way through self-sufficient. Got a basketball scholarship, Division I. It was half basketball, half academics. Absolute stud. And my mother was the blonde bombshell sorority girl that he fell in love with and married. Immediately, I knew that it was that I was born into a family. They're wonderful parents, and they gave me everything I ever needed. But I was born into a family where it was extremely important how we looked. It wasn't necessarily important how we felt. And my father, I'm not going to do his inventory completely, but he drank every day, very highly functioning. And he lived a life, I say highly functioning, that sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds like, wow, I can drink and I can function. The problem that encountered for him is that he made so much money and everyone loved him that he was never able to be given the gift of a bottom. He never had a point in his life where he had to pivot, but we'll get back to that later. I was intimidated by the family I lived in, and I just wanted to look good, and I did not want to let them down. I went to elementary school, and I was a little sign of perfection, little young, little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid. I got great grades. I was liked by, I'm a people pleaser. I was damn well going to be liked by everyone, and I was going to make sure that I had a version of Kevin that got liked by everyone. And I learned how to do that. And so if you said you didn't like me, you were going to get focused on by me in the next week or so until you liked me, God darn it. And I did really well in elementary school. And all was fantastic. My parents were very proud of me, and I was playing the part perfectly. But unfortunately, elementary school ends. And I ended up in junior high school. And I've been told junior high school is awkward for a lot of people. It was definitely awkward for me. Everything changed, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't have the maturity or the coping skills to deal with the change that junior high school brought to me. My friends matured very quickly at that immediate point and wanted to do to start experimenting with drugs and alcohol, and I wanted nothing to do with it. It wasn't because I'm a moral guy. It wasn't because I had a church to tell me not to do it. I just did not want to do it. Every ounce of me did not want to do it. So I started to isolate. That's what I'm really good at. I started to pull away, and I started to wonder where I belonged. I didn't feel like I belonged at home. My grades dropped drastically. My parents started to scramble, wondering what to do with this kid. They didn't have anything to look on. I was the oldest. They didn't have anyone. They didn't choose to go anyone. So I just kind of floundered. My mother, because it was more important what we looked like, my mother started doing my homework. And she dressed me. It was everything. You know, I was just a puppet on a string, and I was miserable, but I never let on that I was miserable. I would cut class, and where most people would cut class and go have fun, go be adventurous, do crazy things. My neighbor across the street, both people worked. There was no one home. I would go sit in their backyard just to avoid society because the pressures, I couldn't take it. They probably weren't even that bad, but you know, my head was just filled with, what am I doing here? I don't know how to get through this. And somehow I got through junior high school, probably with my mother doing my homework, and high school hit. High school, I became, the kid that could float through every section in high school. I'm old enough to where we had a smoking section. I could fit in the smoking section. I could fit with the popular kids. I could fit with the nerds. I could fit with every section, but not fit, if that makes any sense. I could float through. I never stayed in one section for long. And that happened until my junior year, where I started dating my soon-to-be wife. We were high school sweethearts. But I just wanted out. And I was not maturing. I was so immature. When high school hit, my biggest fear was that I heard we had to take showers after PE. And I didn't have an ounce of body hair on me. I was like a 12-year-old boy. And I did not want to do that. And so all these fears like that were always in my head, finding out that we didn't have to take showers after. Like, I would make up all these stories of stuff to be scared of and frightened of. And when I started dating my soon-to-be wife, we had our share of friends, mostly superficial, and I just wanted to get to the next chapter. The problem is that I didn't have any plans for the next chapter. When I say I was immature, I was extremely immature, and I was just being directed by my mother. And I did not have the grades. I got by probably with a 2.1, and in my family, there was no other choice but to go to college. There was no other choice. And of course, I didn't have the fortitude. I didn't have the backbone or anything to go against my parents. And so I went with my arm behind my back to junior college. And once I got there, a little spark of Kevin started to come out. I was drinking a bit at the time, but it definitely wasn't alcoholically. And I knew that I felt like such a loser, and I knew it. And so I don't know I believe it was the first hand of God telling me, but for some reason I was passing a billboard in junior college, and it was go study in London. And I said, gosh, I need to go do that. I wonder if my parents will back me on that. And I went home and I asked, can I go study in London for a year? And they didn't know what to do with me, those poor people. And so they said, yes, before I even finished, they said, we got to do something with this kid. We don't care. If he wants to go, maybe this is a spark. And it was my first time I was scared to death because I was so far out of my comfort zone. I had to go to a place where I didn't know anyone, had to live with people I'd never met. I had to be in a foreign country. And I went, and I started drinking a lot. But I was really happy. I was finally doing something. I had to do my own laundry. I had to make sure I was fed. I had to put my own underwear on. No, she didn't do that for me. I had to really start doing my stuff. And ironically, I got roomed with a kid who was a minister's son who was rebelling. Whew, that was crazy. He at one point, he was sleeping with his eyes open. I had to ask him if he was asleep or awake. He was taking so many drugs and so much was going on. But I matured quickly, and I started getting a glimpse of who Kevin was outside of being controlled. And I started belonging. The crazy thing is that the best happy hour in London was a gay club. But we didn't care. It was the cheapest, best happy hour. And I was very immature and very boyish. Those guys loved me. I was accepted. It was unbelievable. I was fully accepted. Those guys loved me. And so I was like, man, I have found my place. What do I have to do to belong here? And then they told me. And I wanted to belong so bad. Because I finally found, I mean, they were fantastic. But gosh darn you ladies, you're just too attractive, and I couldn't get away from that. That women are my thing, and you guys were. And as much as they tried to talk me into it, I couldn't do it. So once again, I was kicked out, didn't belong. So I went on to that, and that ended, and I came home, and I felt like a completely different person. Not completely different, because while I was gone, my mom applied to all the colleges for me, and I got into Cal Poly. Woo! I'm like, Mom, how did you do that? She's like, I found one major that wasn't impacted. I said, so they took you with a 2.2. So I was off to Cal Poly, and I wasn't too happy about it. I love paychecks. I love getting paid for working. I work hard. I love to do it. I don't not like report cards. I don't like classrooms. I don't like it. But there was no choice in my family, and I wasn't strong enough to do it, so off to Poly I went. And I was really a different person. I was finally, there was a spark, but I joined a fraternity, and that fraternity was crazy, and I fit right in. It was definitely the animal house of Cal Poly. I fit in great. But one thing that's not part of my story, and I think it's another hand of God in my life, is that drugs are not a part of my story. They were all around, yeah, especially cocaine. It was everywhere, and those guys wanted me to do cocaine with them. That's one thing I find out about cocaine users, is they want you to be part of the party to an extreme extent. And I had an incredible CD collection, and so they would always in my room using my CDs to snort it off of. The CD cases. And I never succumbed to that pressure. It's weird. I succumbed to so many other pressures. But because I didn't succumb to those pressures, and because although I was drinking extremely heavily, definitely alcoholically by this point, I became the president of the fraternity for a year. And it's because when the cops came at midnight, I wasn't on drugs. I was just drunk, and so I could deal with the cops. I really think that's why I became the president. And as time went on, we had this big party, and it was the biggest party of the year. It was our Christmas party. And the rules were is that was the one time the president gave up being a president And the vice president took over the responsibilities that night, and the president became Santa Claus. And the rules were that it was open gift exchange, and every alcoholic gift, the Santa Claus had to take a shot of that if it was a bottle of booze. So the party went on, and of course, I don't really remember it, but one of the members of the fraternity, this is an important story, I'll try to go through it quick. One of the members was trying to show off. They had already drank all night long, and he poured a bottle of Wild Turkey 101 into a 64-ounce big gulp cup and drank the whole thing. And they were smart enough, thank goodness, he passed out in their arms, and they were smart enough to throw him in the back of a pickup truck, and we were on California Boulevard, so Sierra Vista was right around the corner. They got him right to Sierra Vista, and they went to work, all of them in fraternity letters. And he, long story short, he survived somehow. He has the record of San Luis Obispo's alcohol. The Oprah did a show on the highest she could find, and the highest she could find was 0.48. He was 0.62. He owns the record in San Luis County, I'm sure, still. Hopefully no one broke that. But his metabolism was so high, he survived, and they got him there so quick, he survived. S-storm hit my life. Every news agency was on at my fraternity house. I was being brought in front of the police. Cal Poly was considering throwing me out. Not because I did it, but because I was the president of the organization that did it. My life was hell at the time. It was extremely stressful. I didn't know what to do. All I knew how to do was to disassociate, and I disassociated with alcohol. And I drank it from morning till night to get out of that, to not have to deal with it. And I was the front page of the Tribune for a day. Little Kevin Dyson was the front page of the Tribune, not for the reasons I wanted to be. I called my parents, and my dad's like, I don't understand what the big deal is. You know, that happens every other weekend in my house. I said, it's a different time, Dad. You get in a fraternity that's in trouble, and you are in deep doo-doo. So I started drinking really heavily then, and I really, really reverted into something I didn't like, and I eventually graduated, and I carried that alcoholism back to San Jose with me. And I was bartending. I bartended through high school, to college. And I was bartending, and it was a wonderful job because I could drink and do my work. And I was really getting nowhere. I was getting ready to marry my wife. I hadn't proposed yet, but it was getting close. And I said, my friend called and said, we move back to San Luis Obispo. I'm going to build a nightclub. And I know you're back from bartending. And I said, yes, get me out of San Jose. This will change everything, right? I'll bartend somewhere else. That'll change everything. And so I came back to San Luis Obispo, and I managed a place called Mother's Tavern for 8 years. The first 8 years it was open. It was a blast. It was incredible. We were busy. We were the best place in town. A lot of money came in, and a lot of money came out, and I was drunk every night, and I did the thing that so many of us I hear do. I'm not going to drink tonight. Tonight I'm just going to work, and I'm going to get through it, and I'll have one night off. I never had a night off. It got so bad that at 2 in the morning when I was counting the tills and getting everyone out, I would use the urinal, and I swore that there was going to be blood coming out of me. I felt so rotten inside. I felt physically rotten. I felt emotionally rotten, but you would have never known. I ran that place. I had to do so many things. Drunk as heck, and I did it, and I did it well, and I don't know how. And that's a problem, because it always forced me from having to deal with what I had. I just kept doing it. That finally ended with my first DUI. I had gotten married and bought a house in Santa Maria, and I was driving home every night from San Luis Obispo to Santa Maria. It was inevitable. I finally got a DUI, and I got picked up from the DUI by my wife and my two children at the time. There's nothing more humiliating coming out of the drunk tank with a minivan opening and two little kids looking at you. It makes you want to cry right now still. I didn't know what to do about it. They gave me a court card. I came to this room. I sat right in those chairs over there for six meetings I had to go to. I don't know if Glenn was in the room. I don't know if Lee was in the room. I don't know who was in that room. It didn't matter to me. I just came. I didn't hear a word. I got my court card signed off, and I was out. I wasn't ready yet. But I did white knuckle it. When I first came in, I said it was 5 years. It was probably 3 or 4 years. I white knuckled it. I stayed sober, and I did my thing. But then my son ended up being very good at soccer, and he made a traveling team. And on the second tournament we had, he was 9 years old at the time. It dawned on me, my wife's not around. No one's around. He's 9 years old. He's not going to know. I can start drinking. It was inevitable. I was always going to find a crack in the system. And I started drinking again. And then I was working for Cal Portland at the time as their IT guy, IT manager. And I had a lot of business trips. And there's another opportunity, right? I can drink on all the business trips. So it started escalating. I was drinking on the business trips. I was drinking at every soccer tournament possible. And there were a lot of those. But it ended up not being enough. I needed more. So I started faking business trips. I started telling my wife I was out of town, and I have a shop in Orchid. I would go drink in that shop and then sleep under the desk and pretend I had been gone. I was as close to full-blown as I could get while hiding it. So I wasn't drinking every day, but if I could, I would. And those days I didn't drink were not fun. And I don't know how well I hit it. It was halfway decent. There was probably a certain amount that my wife at the time probably just didn't want to deal with it anymore. She was probably sick and tired of being my mommy and telling me that it needed to stop and that there was no place in this family for that behavior. I think that she was worn out and she had just given up. And so there was one night that I was, again, drinking in my office, and I got a text from her. And it read, "Where are you really?" And a chill went down my spine. And instead of just say, "Okay, you caught me, let's do something about this," I wish I could do that. I don't have the capability to do that. I'm a liar. And I don't think I have the ability to stop or to get sober. I'm scared to death. My life is toxic. The inside of me, I hate myself. The only thing I know how to do is to continue to try to keep the lie going. And that's the only solution I had in my head. And so, stark, raging, drunk, I jumped in my car. I was supposed to be in the Mojave Desert, and I sped off towards the Mojave Desert, out on the 166. Now, drive 166. The next time you drive it, if you get the pleasure, because it's a beautiful drive. If you get to drive it, find a place where you can go off that road safely. There's not many. I made it all the way to the junction right before Bakersfield where Highway 5 hits, and I ended up with a smashed car in the middle of an agriculture field. I had no idea what had happened. I figured it was something bad. I had no idea if I had hit a lovely family in a station wagon and killed them all. I had no idea. I had no idea why I was out there. But I got out of that car, and I felt an amazing calmness and an amazing, it was the best feeling I'd felt in a long time because I knew it was over. I knew that I couldn't lie my way out of this. My car was smashed. I was in the middle of a field. Luckily enough, I had just been nailed by a semi truck and everything was fine on his end, just a damaged bumper. But it was over for me. In that turn, it was a fork in the road. It was a very dangerous fork in the road. And I decided, sitting in the drunk tank again, that I could go left. If my family didn't stay with me and everyone was finally done with Kevin and this behavior and this horribleness, if they just said, "You're on your own, bro," I was going to take a left turn and I was going to do alcoholism exactly the way I wanted to do it. The way I've always wanted to do it, with every bone and every cell in my body, and that is drink every day as long as I can and be out. Or if they stuck with me, I can do what I believe I don't have the ability to do and what is not gifted to me, and I can go find a way to get sober. And as it turned out, as you can tell, I'm at the podium. They stuck with me. And so we came, I came back to, I spent the night in Kern County Jail, came back to my family, and we got busy right away. And as I mentioned before, I got busy, first thing on it, as I'd been here before on the other court card, I needed to prove to my ex-wife that this place really stank, and the sobriety wasn't here, and a solution wasn't here. Because I needed something to go along with my solution. I needed happiness, I needed thrills, I needed mystery, I needed life to be full, I needed it to be fun, and that was not here. No, you guys had a cup of coffee in this hand and a cigarette in this hand, and you were holding on for dear life, saying, I'm sober. This is all concoction in my head. And I came in to that meeting that Glenn was secretary. I believe you were there. And this place turned, just totally turned it on its head for me. I felt the most... I didn't think I was missing anything. I had no idea. I just wanted to be sober. Other than that, my life was great. You guys showed me I was missing so much. I was missing love and support from others. I was missing so much joy in my life. Everything was so toxic. Everything was so dark. And I thought it wasn't. I thought my life was great. Just this stupid alcohol problem that I'm just going to have to live with until I die. And I can do it, right? I can hang on. Just as long as you guys don't know, I can do it. And you guys turned it on its head and told me there's a solution. And we're going to do it with you. We're going to show you how. And I believed it, thank God. And somewhere in me was this willingness and this hope. And I hit the ground running. And I came to so many meetings. I didn't count. There was no one telling me I had to do 90 and 90. There was no one telling me this is the way to do it. They just said, keep coming back. And I did. And I didn't say anything for the first 3 months. I didn't say a word. I met you guys, but I didn't know how to meet you guys. I was just scared, and you guys were saying things that were so crazy and so awesome, and they were clicking with me, and everything was falling into place. I'm like, how come I didn't hear this stuff before? I'm 48 years old, gosh darn it. Why didn't I hear these tools? Why wasn't I given these tools? The ironic thing is, the longer I've gone on, I was given those tools. I just didn't want to hear it. I was given those tools left and right. I was given solutions to problems in my life. I just didn't want to hear it because I was afraid that it might caused me to have to face my problems. And I didn't want to do that. It was easier to disassociate. So I started listening. I started doing cool stuff because I wanted to meet you guys. And I knew that I couldn't remain on the outskirts for very long. And I couldn't just be a silent person in these meetings and just be listening. Eventually, I had to be part of the herd. And I didn't know how. I was too scared. But thank goodness you guys had little things to do. And that little thing to do that saved me was washing coffee mugs. I wish you guys would bring those mugs back because it meant the world to me. I washed those mugs. A couple times, Glenn wanted to wash the mugs, and I said, you don't need it like I need it. I said, you get out of the way. I'm washing these darn mugs. I thought Glenn had 15 years. I find out now he had a year and a half. The first person to come up and say hi to me with their mug was this young kid. I thought he had 10 years. He was so professional. He was so loving. He's in this darn room tonight. And he came up to me and introduced himself. And all of a sudden, I started meeting people. It was Nate. Came up. And just, I thought these people had so much time. I thought, wow, these young kids got it. How'd they do that? Getting me sober at 25, 26 years old? No way. No way. There wasn't enough pain yet to have to do that, because that's when I pivot is pain. You guys started bringing me into the herd, and it started happening fast. And then I made a big error, and I told Luke, I'm not meeting people fast enough. And all of a sudden, I was the greeter at the Lion's Den. He walked up to Jessica, who was the secretary at the time, and he said, do you need a greeter? And she said, no. And he said, yes, you do. If you have two, now you have three. If you have three, now you have four. And I was a greeter. Got to spend a lot of time that year greeting with Kevin, and it meant a lot to me. I learned so much from so many of these guys in the room, and it was because I was forced to be part of the herd. I was forced, I want to say, it's not things I can do myself. I don't have the ability to get myself sober for a long period of time. I can short periods. I don't have the ability to make those decisions. I don't have the ability to thrust myself into uncomfortable situations like meeting new people. Yes, I'm very social now. It's because I know so many of you. But if I go to a party where I don't know anyone, I am quiet. I am reserved until you gain my trust. And then when you gain my trust, then you want me to go away because I talk too much. But it was the beginning of doing things very uncomfortable for me, like going to London, like doing stuff like that. Because when Kevin's in his comfort zone, it's a bad place. It's a place of non-growth. It's a place that's stale. It gets boring. I need to be thrust out of my comfort zone, and that's where the magic happens. That's where the things start to happen. And you guys did it with such love and such care, and it really meant the world to me. And so there I am in the middle of the herd, and I have several service responsibilities that are really, really helping me out, really making me feel. I have tons of friends in here. I have a sponsor. I have so many things going on. And I say, that's enough. I got this. This is really good. This is how it's going to exist, and it's going to be very good for me. I'll read the book. The book means a ton to me. I'll listen at the meetings, and that's where I'll stop. But I kept noticing that the people that I really, really admired and the people that I really wanted what they had, had done the 12 steps. And there was a seed. No one said, you got to do the 12 steps. No one put their arm behind my back like college was for me. They let me figure it out on my own. And eventually I got to the point where I wanted to do the 12 steps. And I started. I started with my original sponsor. And we got to about the fifth step, and it just didn't feel right. My intuition was very high that this wasn't how they were supposed to be done for me. I know there's no one way to do it, but I just wasn't clicking with the way it was going. And that caused something very uncomfortable, as I hit on before, is that I knew I had to change sponsorship if I wanted to do it in a way that would click. And that was a very hard decision for me. It was very similar to breaking up with a girl, which I have a hard time doing. I'll stay in a toxic relationship if it means not having to break up with her. But eventually I got the courage. I knew it had to happen. I say I got the courage. I was being led by something other than me to do things that Kevin can't do. And I eventually did it. And the ironic thing is he looked at me and said, I thought you did this 2 months ago. Oh, are you kidding me? It was already done. I didn't even have to do it. But I did it, and I moved on to my second sponsor, and we started the steps, and it was a fabulous experience. Fabulous in a rah-rah yay? No. Those steps, what they did is that they took, I thought everything was outside, right? I had my checklist. My checklist was get a degree, get a wife, get a house, own your car, have three children, have a corporate job, all these things on the checklist. And I checked them off. I checked them off during this whole time. But it was empty. There was no happiness at the end of it. Like I was told, there was nothing. Do I love my kids? Oh my gosh, do I love my kids? I wouldn't trade them for the world. Did I love my wife at the time? I absolutely did. Did I like my house? Did I like all those things? I liked them. There was no fire burning tonight. There was no happiness at the end of it, and I couldn't explain it. And so I went through the 12 steps. And what the 12 steps did for me is they tricked me in here where everything was going on. Because I thought everything on that checklist was on the outside, and that's what brought me happiness. The 12 steps forced me inside to where all the disgust, the toxicity, and the grossness resided, and stuff I didn't want to deal with. I had a room. My whole body was a mansion. There was so many rooms. There was rooms for education. There was rooms for family. There was rooms for friends. There were all these places that were wide open that I allowed people in and allowed myself in. But there was this one room. Everything I didn't like about myself, everything I didn't like about you, everything I didn't like about society, everything I didn't like about this stuff, was I opened that room, I shoved it in there, and I shut that darn room, and I let it be. And the 12 steps forced me into that room. They forced me into that room to deal with what was in there. And I knew I had to do it. And so I started opening that room, dealing with each thing that was in that room. I dealt with it, discarded it. Dealt with it, discarded it, just like the 12 steps had me do. And I started emptying that room, and it started to show glimmers of a light in the back of the room. I didn't know what it was. It just was a feeling. And I continued to empty the room with my sponsor and to deal with the things and to do my amends and to face what it was. And the more I got, the more that light shone and the more the room was emptied, and I was able to go in that room finally for the first time in my life. There was enough space to walk in that room, and I wanted to see what that light was really bad. I was very curious. And when there was enough room open, I went back, and that light was finally a presence of a higher power, finally a presence that made me feel like finally once in my life, everything was going to be okay and that I was okay. I got tricked. Because I had no religious background. I had nothing. It wasn't that I had no religious background. I was a clean slate. My parents never talked about it. It wasn't in my house. It wasn't darn those religious people or hooray those religious people or hooray religion. It was benevolent. It was nothing. And so I was a clean slate. And so all of a sudden I felt this presence other than me that was unbelievably, it was cheering me on. It loved me. It wanted the best for me, and I didn't know what to do with it, but man, did it explode my life wide open. And I got to carry that all the way through the rest of the steps. And when I finished, I was thrilled. I had a spiritual awakening. I didn't expect it. I didn't know what that was. I just wanted to be sober. But was it all fun and unicorns and things like that? No. What that meant was, oh my gosh, I have to change everything in my life if I want to maintain this. Everything has to change. And this is to a person that can't change things unless he ends up in the middle of an agricultural field with a smashed car. It's a person that can't change things on his own because doesn't have enough fortitude and enough courage and enough hope. But I knew I had to change it all. And because I had gained that light in that room, things started changing themselves. I can't explain it. I had to divorce my wife at the time because I knew I couldn't stay sober, staying married. And it's not that she's a bad person. She is not a bad person. She stuck with me. It was the dynamic that we had. I was not going to be able to stay sober, and I knew it. And I imagine this. Imagine you're her. You stick with this creep your whole life, high school sweetheart. You stay through. He's an alcoholic causing all this craziness, causing you to have to go to a jail with your two kids and open a minivan and pick him up out of the drunk tank. All this other stuff. He's lying to you. He's doing all this crazy crap. You stick with him. He gets sober, and then he says he has to leave you. Unbelievable. How do I do that? How do I take the slings and arrows from her family? How do I take the judgment? I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to be the villain because I need you to like me. You have to like me. How do I make a change like that? And it just started happening. And she was furious. Her family wasn't furious, strangely. But she was furious. And we went through months of trying to figure it out and trying to figure out that I really was leaving. And all I could do, all that would come through me is I told her, I'm doing this for both of us because I'm holding you hostage. I'm holding you hostage. I'm keeping you from true love. I'm keeping you from what you really deserve in life. And that wasn't my thoughts. It was just coming through me. It was God talking through me. And I said, be patient. Get through this. Like you were enabling me by not telling the world that I was an alcoholic. I'm enabling you to be codependent to someone like me who you need to go find real love. This is your chance. I'm setting you free. And 3 months after we were divorced, she wrote me a letter that said I was right. And she was That's how I got through it, because God was leading me through it. It wasn't just me, in the past, making a selfish decision. I was making a decision for everyone, and it was a very difficult one, and it was quite a test, and I don't know how I did it. That's not to pat myself on the back. It's not. It was very trying, and she's still a wonderful person, and she has found her love, and it's wonderful to see. And so it just, I've learned so much, like through difficult decisions like that, and really harrowing decisions like that. It's a strange shift my life has taken. And the difficult part of being sober for me is to remain in that presence and that vibration of Kevin is not in charge. Because when I'm in charge and when I'm driving the bus, as so many people have said to me in these rooms, I end up in a ditch. I end up in ditches sometimes that the bus can't be pulled out of without a ton of help. But when I surrender the wheel to the higher power and let that person drive the bus, it goes to places that I can't imagine that it would ever go. It's places that I didn't know I needed to go to. It's situations I didn't think I needed to go to. I acquire things I didn't think I needed. Things just happen and that I cannot explain. If I sit and I pray and I say, this hit me the other week. If I prayed the whole time that I was in my disease and I said, please let nothing bad happen to me. Please let nothing bad happen to me. God, if you let something bad happen to me, I will be angry with you. I am trying to pray my way out of my bottom. The best thing that could happen to me is the worst thing at that moment. And so now I never pray for nothing bad to happen to me. Because if I forget where I'm going in this world, I need something bad to happen to me. Blessings aren't always things wrapped up in a beautiful present. Blessings aren't always things that are just gorgeous and, oh, look at me, I got a brand new Ferrari. That hasn't happened yet. In fact, if you saw my car, I still have one of those cars you have when you first get in here. What do they call those? Yeah, I still have one of those. but I have chosen to meditate and to listen instead of praying to me is talking. I've done enough talking. Being the liar and the sack of crud that I am, I've done plenty of talking. I need to start listening. I need to start bringing into life what is unexpected. And if it doesn't come, if as things happen, if it comes ugly and if it comes bad, I don't look and go, woe is me. Oh, it's always me. I try to flip it and go, what's the lesson here? What is it leading me towards? Where should I pivot? Now that I have the ability to pivot with God, now that I have the ability to do things that Kevin can never do with God, I can take good, I can take bad, and I can go, man, that was good. That was great. I accept it. I am so grateful. If it's bad, I go, what are you trying to teach me? Where do I go from here? Where is the growth? What a difference, man. What a difference. Going from a person lying so he can keep his disease going because he's so afraid of who he is outside of it. Another blessing is that I don't know where the craving for alcohol went. I do not know. I couldn't go a day without thinking about when the next time I could drink it was. And when I was drinking it, I couldn't stop thinking about where the next one was. When I came in here, I was trying to figure out how do I explain my alcoholism? How do I keep up with some of the drunkologues in here that I can't keep up with? And this right here. That thing, I know when alcohol hits my lips and gets on my tongue, I can't stop. There's nothing I can do about stopping. And if I run out, there's nothing you can do to stop me from getting more. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll drive. I'll do despicable things. I can't stop. And where that went, the thoughts of alcohol, I don't know who relieved me of them, but that is an absolute blessing. I get to go to any wedding I want to go to. I get to go to any party I want to go to. If normies go into a bar, I can go into a bar without fear, without anything in the back of my head, back of my mind. I am so done with alcohol. And as I say in a lot of my shares, someone could come into that door right now with the best news ever and say they've invented a pill and it relieves alcoholism. And if you take this pill, you can drink again normally and you don't have to worry about it ever again. And I would tell that person to take a flying leap and get the heck out of here. I don't need it. I don't want it. Life, what a life in sobriety has given me, I can't even explain. And I don't want to explain it because the best things that have come my way are unexplainable. How did I get divorced? How did I stay sober? How did I meet the beautiful people in these rooms? I can't explain it. I've just been led, and something really cares about me. Something really does want me to have a great life. And if I can somehow continue to stay out of the way of that presence, out of the way of that energy, then I get to stay here, and I get to stay here with you beautiful people. It takes a lot of courage to be in here. It takes a lot of courage to come in and be a newcomer. And man, if I could show everyone who hasn't seen it yet what's over that mountain and the beauty that's behind the uncomfortableness, out of the disasters we've created, out of the stuff dealing with it, what's on the other side of that mountain, I would. But man, it's one of the most beautiful things of sobriety is that all of us are on our own path. All of us get all the awakening to happen. All of us get to have these wonderful things come back into our own lives. And there's nothing anyone can do. It's all about having the courage in ourselves, going within, cleaning house, and then waiting for the blessings to happen. I haven't heard one person who stayed sober that said that, man, that was the worst move I ever made in my life. Man, everything was going great until I got freaking sober. I haven't heard one person say that, and we're all so worth it. There was a lot of my life when I said I wasn't worth it, and then I couldn't do it, and it wasn't there for me, and it was for some people, but not for me. What a lie. What an absolute lie. It just took some courage and some willingness, and it took a heck of a lot of people around to support me. I need you guys every day of my life, and you guys never let me down, not even once, not even a hair. I'm so appreciative for this program. I'm so appreciative for people that are cheering me on. I'm so appreciative for a higher power that's cheering me on, because man, we can, anything that comes my way, is my life perfect? Oh no, my life ain't perfect, but it's perfect the way it unfolds every day. Good or bad, I'm living, I'm sober, and I'm amongst you people.